Case number 23458, Bob Post versus City of Monroe Falls, Ohio, et al. Argument not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. McLandrich, you may proceed for the appellants.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. John McLandrich for the appellants, which are Mayor Armstrong, Law Director Kostoff, and Chief Hughes. As the court knows, this is a qualified immunity appeal that arises from the termination of Mr. Post's employment as a sergeant with the police department. It's a qualified immunity with respect to a First Amendment issue, First Amendment retaliation claim. There are also state law claims, a malicious prosecution and a defamation claim, as well as a conspiracy claim. It's our position that the district court did not apply the correct legal standard to the qualified immunity analysis and also erred with respect to the other state law claims. With respect to the qualified immunity issue, the critical issue from our perspective is that the court did not consider the question of whether a reasonable public official could have believed that the termination of Mr. Post was lawful in light of the clearly established law. As we all know, there is a general clearly established right to be free from retaliation for engaging in protected speech. However, that's just the generalized right at issue. The jurisprudence with respect to qualified immunity provides that the court has to move beyond that general right to the particularized circumstances at issue. In this matter, Mr. Post, you know, the conduct in this case is almost all essentially admitted conduct. Mr. Post clearly admits, and it's confirmed that he ran these individuals on leads. He was at a civil standby with respect to serving, or not even serving, but delivering papers to a person in the Homeowners Association of which he was a member. That material was presented to the city's police advisor. City's police advisor came to the conclusion that this was a felony violation, improper use of leads. His recommendation was to refer that to the grand jury, to the prosecutor's office, excuse me, and it was referred to the prosecutor's office. The prosecutor's office made the decision to refer to the grand jury, which chose to indict. The plaintiff argued that there was exculpatory evidence that was withheld from the grand jury. Simply not the case. The alleged exculpatory evidence apparently referred to by the district court were two things. One is an email from the former chief of police that doesn't even reference the use of leads. It's a two-line email. Wasn't part of the official policies of the city. That information is admitted not to have been known by the chief of police at the time the matter was referred to the grand jury. So it couldn't be exculpatory evidence that he withheld, even assuming arguendo someone was to view it as exculpatory, which we certainly don't believe it is.
Does this go all to the state law malicious prosecution claim? Is that what we're arguing today, right now?
Well, they're interrelated in the sense that the defendant's view of the officer's conduct forms the backdrop for their decision-making with respect to the termination of employment, which informs the First Amendment claim.
I think their argument is that all this had nothing to do with the termination, that Mr. Post was terminated because of his exercise of his First Amendment rights, and that all this is somewhat interesting background material, but it's not what motivated the termination. Well, and they're saying there's an issue of fact as to what actually motivated the termination.
That's certainly their argument, Your Honor. But if the court looks at the not only the pre-termination hearing, but the decision of the hearing officer, and therefore the basis of the termination, was two things. One was the improper use of leads, and the other was the almost 3 hours that he spent at a homeowner's meeting on duty.
Okay, they counter by saying that, first of all, he was allowed to go to the meeting for an hour, I think, and he spent a couple other hours there, and that that was really rather a minor infraction, and that the use of the leads that similarly situated officers had not been terminated, that there was one who, much more grievous situation, had a 5-day suspension. And that if you look at similarly situated people, that termination isn't really what the conduct warranted.
So there's a couple of things about that. One, the issue of whether it warrants termination or not is separate from whether they could reasonably believe the termination was appropriate under these circumstances.
But isn't that a factual issue? And we don't resolve factual questions on a denial of qualified immunity, do we?
I don't think it's a factual question at all, Your Honor, with all due respect. I mean, he admitted to running these people on leads, and it's clear that that's not a proper use of leads.
Does it qualify for termination? Does it mandate termination or a lesser sanction?
Well, at the time he was terminated, the city police advisor had come to the conclusion that this was felony misconduct. And so if it's felony misconduct, it certainly justifies termination. Likewise, the 3 hours on duty at this homeowners meeting is improper use of city time. And I don't think that anyone could say that that conduct, that no reasonable public official could believe that that conduct justifies termination. So that's, but even beyond that, the court didn't even consider the issue of whether a reasonable public official could come to that conclusion. And that's not a proper application of the qualified immunity analysis.
What about the evidence of the mayor having the altercation in the parking lot? Is that just, in your view, irrelevant evidence?
No, I wouldn't say that it's completely irrelevant. I mean, certainly it's part of the factual backdrop to this. There was a back and forth between Mr. Post and the mayor in the parking lot. What's, you know, to the extent there's a factual question in this case, that's one of the few in terms of who was the aggressor or the more obnoxious, if we will, party in that dialogue between them. There's no question that the dialogue occurred, and but you know, that's not the protected speech at issue. So it's sort of a.
But isn't it evidence of linking the protected speech to the ultimate termination? Is that not potential evidence of showing a linkage and causation between the two?
I certainly think that if I was plaintiff, and plaintiff did argue, and I'm sure will in a moment argue, that demonstrates part of their motivation to terminate him for the public speech. And so, yeah, I would certainly say that dialogue in the parking lot can be used as one fact to argue that his termination was motivated by the protected speech. I get that.
Why isn't that enough then to create a disputed issue here?
Well, what it is even if one assumes there's a disputed issue with respect to motivation, it still leaves us with the fundamental question of whether any objectively reasonable public official could terminate a police officer who uses leads improperly and spends 3 hours on duty at a meeting of a homeowners association of which he's a member. They try to engage in this justification for being at the homeowners meeting that he's there to keep the peace. But there's no question in the record that this homeowners meeting is of the like-minded individuals, a subgroup of the homeowners that are trying to oust the board.
So you're saying the altercation would be evidence of subjective belief of retaliation, but not objective belief?
Certainly. Well, I mean, it's part of the fact pattern that the court could decide, can take into consideration in whether any objectively reasonable public official could believe they could terminate Mr. Post under these circumstances. And there's no question that this was not a criminal enterprise that he was out on. this was a civil standby at best. And, you know, the fact that he's a member of that homeowners association and they arrange for this call to come in when he's only one of two people on duty so that it's assured that he's going to go on this call is also part of the matrix of facts that these decision makers could take into account. I frankly can't see any clearly established law that would ever tell a chief of police or a mayor or a law director that an individual who's misusing leads can't be terminated. Now, whether the other two individuals should have been terminated is a separate question. Perhaps they should have, but as we all know, the law doesn't need to be applied to everyone to be applied to someone. If we look back at the cases of the 60s, the selective prosecution cases, you know, they would arrest one guy on the steps of the courthouse burning his draft card when 50 people were burning them. And the courts have uniformly said, the fact that it wasn't enforced against everyone doesn't mean it can't be enforced against someone. I just can't imagine a world, frankly, where someone's engaged in a felony misuse of leads and the public officials can't be reasonably seen to be justified in their termination.
Counsel, you keep using the word could. That a reasonable, it's an objective standard, a reasonable government official could terminate him for this. Isn't the standard would rather than could?
I don't believe so, not in the qualified immunity context, no. But quite frankly, even in the would context, I think that it's more than justified. I mean, there's no clearly established law that anyone is cited to in this case that would tell them they couldn't terminate or wouldn't terminate for this. But I believe the standard is could, Your Honor.
Okay. All right. Any further questions at this point, Judge Batchelder, Judge Bush?
No.
All right. You'll have your 4 minutes rebuttal. Let's hear from the appellee.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Christopher Lalek, and I am counsel for appellee Bob Post. So as we had just touched on here in the conversation with my counterpart, the jurisdiction in this case is, of course, limited to only consideration of pure issues of law. Now, as we saw in the briefing and we heard here again just now, appellants purport to concede this well-settled concept, but nevertheless, we have disputes of material fact throughout their arguments on briefing and here today. Rather than accepting, as they must for the purposes of this appeal, the district court's inferences of facts, as well as construing the facts in the light most favorable to plaintiff, instead appellants insist on their own statement of facts and improperly color the facts in the light most favorable to them. Predictably, this has yielded arguments over which this court simply has no jurisdiction. Now, getting right to the material, now I'll have to rely on the briefing for a complete recitation of the facts that are in dispute here, but turning just to the most critical ones here, first and foremost, appellants, as we just heard, saw in the briefing and heard again now, are incorrectly stating that it is undisputed that Post improperly accessed leads in connection with the date in question of November 29th of 2017. That just defies the record. There's absolutely a dispute on that issue. For example, that overlooks Post testimony as to what the policy is, that the policy is not simply just this, as Mr. McLennan put it, just a two-line email, I think is what he described to it as. In fact, we have testimony about what the policy has been for a long period of time. We have a statement from Patrolman Roble, who mentioned that he didn't complete the required reports, which to actually complete them requires running leads, because he wasn't the primary officer on duty. We have the declaration testimony of city council.
So let me ask a question here if I might.
Yeah.
But isn't one of the things we need to look at here not only what had been the policy or maybe still even was, but what did the mayor believe the policy was? Because if he thought that the violation had occurred, if he believed that, even if he was wrong, then that still is something we would have to, and the district court would have had to take into account, isn't it?
That is absolutely correct, Your Honor. But here, the evidence shows that we have evidence both you see it in, I don't want to just be limited to what I'm thinking of off the top of my head, but we have Councilman Barnes's declaration that says, look, I know what the policy is. It was required to run leads. And Chief Hughes deliberately was withholding this evidence. He was deliberately not taking this into account. So what we have here is not, we don't have, this case is not one of simple, just negligence. I didn't know that policy. This is a matter of a chief of police, some remaining, according to the record evidence construed in the light most favorable to plaintiff, deliberately withholding, remaining willfully ignorant as to the policy of what apparently is a very important policy that affects his department.
But is this relevant to the employment termination, or is this relevant to the state law claims?
This is relevant to the entire course of conduct, Your Honor.
We wouldn't want to be just looking at what the chief knew. We'd want to be looking at what the mayor knew.
That's correct. That is correct as well. And what we have here, and we have the evidence of that as well here, Your Honor, in the form of the fact that we do have disparate treatment of the different officers, Roble and Durant. Now, notice that my counterpart mentioned that, well, there was the selective prosecution cases. He's referring to some criminal law cases that are irrelevant here. As the district court found, disparate treatment is absolutely evidence of pretext, which is relevant in an employment termination decision. This is not a selective prosecution case where we're dealing with a criminal prosecution. We are dealing with pretext. You have, as had been pointed out, far more egregious instances of actual leads violations, not leads violations to complete a required report pursuant to policy, but you have actual egregious violations, which were greeted with very mild punishments, slap on the wrist type punishments. Now, all of this, though, really a lot of this discussion as to factual disputes really gets to part of the issue here with jurisdiction, because what we have here is, I don't see very much effort. Well, I misspoke on that. I do not see anything resembling a pure issue of law over which this court could have jurisdiction. For example, though, these factual disputes are coloring anything that might resemble one. A good example of this is with respect to this leads violation. Appellants argue that appellee has failed to provide a case in which a law enforcement officer affirmatively misused leads, and must find that in order to establish the clearly established prong of the qualified immunity analysis. Well, those aren't the facts that we're dealing with here, not on appeal. I understand that they may want to present those to it. They may want a jury to find that, but of course that's not relevant here on an interlocutory appeal. Because those issues of fact color absolutely everything that we're talking about here today, there's really no jurisdiction, or no argument at least, over which this court has jurisdiction to entertain. The same is true of both qualified immunity analysis and as well as the state law analysis, which also the jurisprudence on that is identical in that when you have an appellants who are relying on an entirely different set of facts, simply no jurisdiction as decided in the Cheshire versus Nyer case. And that as applies to the state law immunity claims as well. Now, in addition to that, we have some statements in the record, in appellant's arguments that not only misrepresent the record, but also misrepresent even the district court's analysis. Specifically, appellants argue that the district court affirmatively made a finding that there was a causal connection between Post statements and his termination. Of course, this is not what the district court found. In reality, the district court found that there is a material issue of fact which exists between the two. The appellants also argue that this decision was reached without meaningful analysis, and that it was all just essentially speculation. Well, that's again not true. The district court specifically cited two disparate treatment between the between the other officers that we've already discussed. So there was evidence here. And again, these are determinations that really there isn't jurisdiction over. So with that being said, I know that there is case law from this court where it's been discussed that, you know, when you have what appellants are doing here, which is just contesting the facts, despite paying lip service to the actual record or the actual standard, what should be done is you take you should basically separate the entwined disputes of fact from the issues of law. And then once you've discarded the questions of fact, fact-based evidence sufficiency, the questions that are basically quibbling, as this court has put it before, with the district court's weighing of the evidence, you discard that, and then you address the issues over which this court does have jurisdiction. The issue here, though, is that really once you've discarded the fact-based issues and the questions of evidence sufficiency, you're left with nothing. So there's really no arguments that we can really go to that don't go to the facts. Now, with that said, if we were to, notwithstanding all the impermissible arguments, if we were to undertake a review of the issues just independently of these arguments, the conclusion would be to affirm the denial of qualified immunity. Just going through the First Amendment analysis, we have the elements met here as to a constitutional deprivation of a constitutional right, retaliation and violation of the First Amendment. And just to go through those, I mean, you have that that FLE engaged in constitutionally protected activity. That's not contested. We have that he was subjected to an adverse employment action. That's also not contested. Now, what is contested is whether or not there's a causal connection. But again, district court found dispute of fact. Therefore, qualified immunity should not be granted. And also, there's the issue as there at trial, there's going to be a fact-based issue for appellants as to whether or not they had a legitimate non-retaliatory reason. But that's just not an issue here. Now, as to the question of whether or not there was a clear right established, the right of a police officer, or I'm sorry, put it this way, it is well settled in this court, and I can rely on the briefing on this, that a public employee's right to speak on matters of public concern without facing improper government retaliation is well settled, has been for decades. To the extent that is too generalized, which it wouldn't be pursuant to our jurisprudence, I would argue. With that said, we have C versus City of Elyria, which is cited, that's a 2007 case, long before here, that found that a statement made by a police officer, which was criticizing public official, is well settled and well established already.
Maybe we can move along. I think I understand your retaliation argument. I don't understand the defamation claim. How do you have defamation against these defendants individually? And what exactly is the defamation that occurred?
Sure. So Your Honor, I would first note that for the purpose of the state law claims, the analysis of that is limited to just whether or not just the issue as to malicious purpose, recklessness.
What did they do to defame your client?
So they made, there were false statements that were made about him at various points.
To who and when? And the defamation has to be to the public, I assume. So there's public statements to the public that are false. And
right.
And who made them and when did they make them and to whom did they make them?
Sure. So starting first, we have, let's start with Mayor Armstrong. We have his statements according to the record evidence, and construed in the light most favorable to the plaintiff, which is what the standard is here, we have him confronting Post angrily, not just the verbal confrontation, but actually banging on the window. And then
he defames your client by talking to him? That's not.
No. Oh, Your Honor, not by just, sorry, I'm taking too long to get there. Not just by doing it, but then after the fact, he immediately says, This guy came out of nowhere at me. He's got to be suspended. So he suspends.
Who did he say that statement to?
He said that He said that publicly with respect to making his at numerous city council meetings and with respect to putting post on a leave of absence pending a pending an investigation.
Okay, putting him on leave of absence, is that's the internal investigation. I don't think that's a public statement, but perhaps maybe at the city council it is. How about the other? Is your defamation only against the mayor or is it against the other ones too?
So the surviving claim is against not just the mayor, but also against Chief Hughes, which Chief Hughes here made numerous misstatements
but in public that are untrue.
Yes. And even that would, one good example would be the press release that he made following the termination, the statements that were also made in connection with with the disciplinary hearings and the statements that were made at public council at various public council meetings.
What are you claiming that Law Director Kostoff did that was unlawful or wrongful?
So Kostoff is involved in the First Amendment retaliation.
How was he involved?
And he was involved in it because we have in the record evidence of him being aware and approving the discipline, the disparate discipline against Post versus the disparate discipline against Roble and Durant. So it's essentially with him approving both of those courses of action, he has to have been involved in order to have essentially reached those two conclusions.
He had to approve the discipline in each instance.
Put more simply, Your Honor, how could the same person be aware of both of those without raising any questions? How could he without any involvement?
In the decision making to discipline, though, he was in the chain of command. Is that your?
Yes, Your Honor. He was in the chain of command, and he had final. He signs off on the discipline.
I have one final question, just a factual question, if you don't mind.
Yes, Your Honor.
I'm going to ask one. The timing of the grand jury indictment, did it occur before the decision was made to terminate Post?
So it occurred, I believe, after the decision. It occurred after the decision, I believe, because. Yes, that is correct. It did occur after the decision because they made the decision to terminate Post, and then they released a press statement and said that they were going to seek prosecution. That was when I say they, I mean Hughes.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Any further questions, Judge Batchelder? Judge Bush?
No, thank you.
All right. Thank you, counsel. Thank you. All right. We have 4 minutes of rebuttal.
Yes, thank you. I wanted to clear up one thing that you and I were talking about earlier, Judge Griffin. The difference between the would and could standard. So with respect to the last prong of the First Amendment claim, in other words, if the defendants would have terminated him, notwithstanding the protected conduct, that's where the would standard exists. Yeah. But with respect to whether there's qualified immunity in terms of that would standard, the qualified immunity standard is the could standard. And so that actually both are in play. It's would at the First Amendment merits level analysis, but in terms of whether they could have reasonably believed they were acting in compliance with the law under the qualified immunity, that's the could aspect of it. To correct a misstatement by plaintiff's counsel, there's no question that Chief Hughes, he admits it in his brief, did not know of the POSA email until after the matter was referred to the grand jury, until after Post was terminated. And that email, it's in the record, it's 2-3 sentences long, it doesn't mention Leeds. Someone who reads that, even assuming arguendo they read it, which there's no evidence he did until Post termination, wouldn't inform him of this alleged policy. And as soon as the chief found out about it, he supplied it to the grand jury. If you're looking to railroad somebody, you don't send it to the grand jury to the prosecutor's office, excuse me, once you find out about it, which wasn't until October, some 3 months or so after the indictment. Contrary to their arguments, we're not arguing the issues of material fact here. And quite frankly, when mistakes are made in the record, it doesn't preclude us from raising those mistakes in the record. What we can't challenge is the district court's analysis of the facts. Now, the only two things that were allegedly withheld by Chief Hughes, one is the Posa email, which now we know wasn't withheld, and the other are these supposed statements or statements that were made by residents about Post being asked to come to neighborhood homeowners association meetings. Those are not exculpatory statements. And whether something is exculpatory is a question of law for the court, not a question of fact for the jury. With respect to the defamation issues that were raised, if Mayor Armstrong believes that Post was the more aggressive party in that confrontation between them in the parking lot, I don't see how that can be seen as a factual statement that can be deemed to be defamatory. The Sheriff's Department investigated that altercation for a policy violation and came to the conclusion that it was he said, she said, and they couldn't make a determination. On that scenario, how can it be anything other than an unverified statement of opinion? And so there's that. With respect to whether there was a Leeds violation, what I said was the use of Leeds was undisputed by Mr. Post. The advice that was given to the chief by his lawyer, the police legal advisor, was that it was a violation of Leeds. That is undisputed as well. The only knowledge of the defendants was that they had a Leeds violation. And so, and that's a felony violation. And so based on the admitted behavior of attending this meeting for 3 hours on duty and admitted behavior of running Leeds in a civil matter, they had a reasonable, objectively legally reasonable belief that they could terminate on that basis. And I see I'm out of time, so I would ask the court to reverse unless there's a question.
All right, any further questions, Judge Batchelder?
No, thank you.
Judge Bush, all right. Thank you, counsel. Case will be submitted. You may call the next case.
Thank you for your time, Your Honors.
You're welcome. Thank you for your arguments.